Welcome to this special highlights program from a CME Satellite Symposium held the day before the beginning of the December ASH meeting in Orlando. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. For this symposium, we asked three oncologists in community-based practice to select patients they're treating for MDS, AML, APL, and multiple myeloma to present to our faculty of Drs. Bill Benziger, Maury Gertz, Pierre Fineau, Farhad Ravandi, Ravi Veej, and Doug Smith. You'll hear excerpts from the meeting later on in the program, but to begin, during the meeting, attendees were encouraged to submit questions to the faculty by a handheld PDA, and we promised to address some of these in this audio program. So to begin, I met with Dr. Smith to answer some of the questions we received about MDS, AML, and APL, and we started with a very interesting question about MDS. Okay, so here's the first one. How do you approach older patients with CHF and MDS?
Yeah, a challenge. Patients with MDS have significant cytopenias and often require a lot of transfusions, which necessitates volume shifts in their body. So physiologically, that's the challenge. You don't want them to have too low of a blood count because that's a strain on the heart. And obviously, when you give them transfusions, they take a long time because you don't want to strain the heart by volume. So you're really caught in the middle. We have actually pressed local physicians and colleagues to consider therapy to try to minimize the transfusion needs in these patients. Because in fact, if you can make someone transfusion independent, you can limit or lessen those body physiology shifts from fluid. So I think that's high on my list when I get a patient that comes to me with a low ejection fraction, some mild congestive failure, and they were discovered to have MDS, I say, geez, we should try to treat you. And that may be counterintuitive to people out there. They may be saying, geez, we don't want to treat Grandpa Jones with his heart failure because we may make him sicker. I've found just the opposite. If you can get Grandpa Jones transfusion independent, you can actually make a positive impact on not only their bone marrow, but the type of maintenance you need for their congestive failure as well.
Interesting. Here's another one. What data do we have for the use of ESAs in high-risk MDS?
Not so much. Most of the data have been in patients with lower risk, and a lot of the data are from the era prior to having an IPSS to use to help risk stratify. We do know, and I do know from personal experience, and there are studies that have used ESAs as single agents, ESAs as part of, for example, chemotherapy regimens, and ESAs as part of DNA methyltransferase inhibitor regimen. So in fact, we do know that you may be able to benefit some patients, and it's the same algorithm that we use, which is patients with low erythropoietin levels, regardless of the risk status of their MDS, tend to benefit from ESA. So I do encourage early on people being worked up for MDS, you need an erythropoietin level to help you understand which of the agents might really benefit your patients.
So here's another one. I actually think I remember hearing Dr. Garcia Manero talk to me about this question in another program, another context. Does the faculty recommend any dose reduction or delay in cytopenic meds in patients who are being treated with hypomethylating agents, I guess for MDS? What do you do with the patient who gets cytopenic one treatment?
Two strategies, and I don't know that I'm going to give your listeners a definitive answer here. In patients with lower and intermediate risk MDS, for example, I have believed that if you're getting significant cytopenias, you do want to delay because that's telling you that your dose may be too high. You're getting a cytotoxic effect of the agent and not necessarily a demethylating effect. In patients with sort of higher risk disease, maybe that patient's really transitioning between MDS and AML, I've been more hesitant to give significant delays simply because we've been anxious that their disease will continue to progress and their disease needs some of that cytotoxicity, if you will. So what I'll say is that I may not have the best answer for all the patients, but the way I've thought about this is that in lower risk patients, lots of cytopenias, I do delay the demethylating agent for the next cycle or two to make sure I'm not getting too much cytotoxicity. and to make sure I don't take the patient to a place where they have cytopenias for too long and putting me at risk for infections and other complications. Patient with higher risk disease, I'm willing to put up with that cytotoxic effect that results in the cytopenias because I'm trying to actually get them through a few rounds to clear out their bone marrow. So your ability to tolerate cytopenias may vary based on the individual patients that you're taking care of and how aggressive their disease is.
Yeah, it really makes a lot of sense. Here's another one. For low-risk MDS with normal karyotype after treatment with EPO, which should be the first systemic therapy? Is there a role for lenalidomide?
The answer is yes, there's a role for lenalidomide, and I have kept it very simple in my own mind. If the MDS is primarily involving cytopenias of red cells, I think lenalidomide is the natural next choice. We know with lenalidomide, the responses are erythroid-based. So if you really have a patient that has low-risk disease, has red cell needs, and you want to try to get them transfusion independent, lenalidomide is a very effective drug. 25% of the time or so, people become transfusion independent on that drug, and it's pretty well tolerated in this group of patients. On the other hand, low-risk patients who have more than just red cell needs or have significant other cytopenias, the DNA methyltransferase inhibitor class of drugs can really improve trilineage responses, and so you can get improvements of all cell lines. And that's how I've sort of divided patients up.
In general, what agent do you use off study? What schedule?
In general, our group at Johns Hopkins has really used a lot of 5-azacitidine as our primary drug, in part because of our familiarity with it, and again, in part because of the data from the survival study that showed improved survival with this agent. We have tried in patients where we've established our goal of therapy is to improve survival. We have tried to stick with the 7-day regimen, and we've started people at 75 milligrams per meter squared. We often give it intravenously because many of our patients have semi-permanent catheters in place. We are lucky to have a clinic that will allow us to give this drug 7 days a week. We know that that's a challenge for practices. And when push comes to shove and we talk with practices, we'll say to them, listen, if you have to go to a secondary schedule, we often suggest 5 days a week because that's very practical and very easy to deliver for many practices out there.
Another question related to that is, what about AZA orally?
5-azacitidine, there is an oral formulation now, and that's exciting. It is currently only available on study, so it's not yet FDA approved. They've completed the phase 1 pharmacology study where they've actually tested patients and found through a dose escalation process, gotten good drug levels and effectiveness. And now they're branching out into a larger study looking to confirm efficacy of the orally available agent.
Am I thinking right that Dr. Garcia Manero presented some stuff on that at ASH?
He did. There's a group led by Garcia Manero and colleagues. We participated in the study in Baltimore looking at the oral agent and trying to figure out how to confirm that it's bioequivalent and that it is just as effective as the IV. And ultimately, I think it would be a great tool to have as a physician taking care of a lot of patients with MDS to be able to use this drug orally. It would be very easy and great for our patients.
Yeah, it kind of gets into another question I see here, but you know, I'm also thinking the oncologist dealing with patients of all kinds of cancers in terms of that model of a longer-term oral therapy. They do that a lot in breast cancer with hormone therapy as an example. But anyhow, so here's this question. Some patients with MDS get into complete CBC remission on azacitidine for a long time, parentheses, my patients for 20 months, for example, but then their MDS recurs. Is there a role for decitabine in that situation? What other suggestions?
The situation that's presented is a common one for physicians that take care of patients with MDS. And in fact, most patients, even those that have great responses to 5-azacitidine, will eventually progress. Conceptually, we don't believe that there's a role for a second DNA methyltransferase inhibitor. There are anecdotal reports. We all have them. Someone sent to me on decitabine and wasn't responding anymore, and we gave him a few cycles of azacitidine and it worked. There's anecdotal reports both ways, but ultimately we tend to look for a different approach thinking that the two DNA methyltransferase inhibitors have similar mechanisms of actions, and it's unlikely to get a long-term benefit from switching the drug.
You know, it's interesting that you think about the oral, I mean, it kind of buzzing around in my head, the oral formulation. What about patients who get out after over a year? You know, people talk about, well, maybe you extend the duration a little bit or, you know, compromise, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, do you ever stop people? And do you think that the oral might end up having people treated longer?
I think that is a great question and a key thought. I agree with you. Blood cancers need to figure out a way to maintain good remissions, maintain bone marrow stability. We know the bone marrow is so dynamic that if we quit our therapies, it's eventually going to go back to the same problem of MDS or leukemia. So yeah, I believe that if we had an oral agent, we could probably get patients to stay on the drug longer, and that may translate into some benefit. I believe that there's also strategies with these drugs that we're developing right now, and that is if you have a patient with a poor risk disease like AML and you get a solid remission and they don't have any other options, does it make sense to try to keep and maintain them in that with a low dose of a drug like a 5-azacitidine, for example? This is being studied on clinical trials right now, and it's a concept that I think we need to push ahead with a lot of our new biologically active drugs.
Yeah, I mean, again, I know it's a different disease, but, you know, you give an aromatase inhibitor to a woman with metastatic breast cancer, everything shrinks down and she's doing better. You don't stop it, but and it's just kind of something we're used to, but who knows if that's going to apply here. What kind of quality of life issues do you think these demethylating agents, hypomethylating agents create? I hear mostly about, like, inconvenience. People don't want to go to the office. They don't like the IV or the injection. But beyond that, do you find patients who just don't feel good?
I do. I think that you can sort of box these into certain categories. I think that there is a routine you must develop in order to get a drug monthly, like a 5-azacitidine. So you've got to develop a routine, and that interferes with your travel, your family life, your work, because 1 week out of the month, you've got to be receiving this drug in an office. Number two, you've got to watch your blood counts because, in fact, your blood counts will change and will cycle with the administration of these drugs. We know that after the first couple of months of these therapies, the azacitidine-induced cytopenias appear to lessen. And so you've got to build yourself a pattern of how you're being followed, how your count's being monitored. Early on, a common side effect turns out to be some nausea. That dissipates over time. And what people are really left with is a week of getting the drug, 5 days or a week of feeling a little bit low. They start to feel a little bit better, another week or 10 days, and it's soon time to get back in there again. So I do believe that people have that type of pattern. Interestingly, I would love to know, and I'll be eager to see the data when they're available, does the oral have less of this type of reaction? Is it a little bit gentler on the system in some way that you have less downtime in between the cycles? Because I believe that that is important. I'll say one other thing about this, that MDS is a tough disease to go solo with, and family and caregivers and friends that participate, maybe bringing someone to the doctor's office for a transfusion or to get the drug and take them home and to sort of help carry the load while they're having their down week. We can't forget about caregivers. They're really important, and they play a big role in helping patients get through a prolonged course of therapy such as a 5-azacitidine.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Okay, here's a good one. What's the role of combination lenalidomide plus hypomethylating agents in patients with intermediate 2 or high-risk MDS with deletion 5q and additional complex cytogenetics? I mean, we had a smart audience there, you know?
Wow, somebody's asking about a patient that they know really well there.
Yeah.
What I'll tell you is we're going to go back to this guy, Garcia Manero, really one of the outstanding MDS docs in the country. And he has, again, led a group that has trying to develop this combination. We know that each of these agents has proposed a mechanism of action that are different. And in fact, early on, the first report came out in ASH a year ago, and more recently it was followed up in this year's ASH, showing a very nice response in what we'll call intermediate and higher risk patients to the combination. I think they've found that the combination is tolerable with some modification of the doses. And so I believe that this is a strategy that people are going to want to look at moving forward.
Here's another one. I have a young patient with grade 4 anemia, normal karyotype, no comorbidity, no available bone marrow donor, and no response to ESAs or decitabine. Now what?
This is a patient that we think very hard about, I think, one of two pathways. One would be a clinical trial pathway, and that's always my cop-out, but I really believe it, that if you have the ability to refer a patient for a potential clinical trial, I think that patient is pretty well served that way.
So before you get off that, if a patient like that comes to you right now, what kind of trial do you have?
Well, we've got three different trials probably for this type of patient. We've got trials looking at growth factor type program, so-called differentiation therapy, where we combine drugs like bexarotene with a growth factor. There's drugs called bryostatin we've combined with growth factors where we've seen improved cytopenias and responses.
What kind of growth factors?
White cell growth factor, so GM-CSF is our growth factor.
Wow.
We try to force differentiation of the abnormal clone, resulting in improved counts and often improved bone marrow blasts as well.
That's different.
We have immunologic strategies, which would include things like a alternative donor transplant for someone with a pretty high-risk MDS or someone that I was fearful would eventually transform. And then we have your basic sort of single agent or combination MDS-based trials, one of which would include high doses of Revlimid, looking at ways to try to improve the red cell mass in such a patient. So we do have clinical trials that we try to gear our individual patients towards. That, to me, should always be an option for patients. If you don't have that option, I certainly, in a low-risk patient, after they did not respond to decitabine, I certainly wouldn't hesitate to consider them for a drug like lenalidomide for these patients. We know that this agent is very good at erythroid responses, and you've mentioned that your patient really struggles with red cells. This certainly might be a reasonable drug, and I would tell you somewhere between 20 and 30% chance that they're going to have a significant red cell response if they meet the criteria you've mentioned.
Interesting. Here's another one. When do you start chelation in MDS?
5 years ago, I would say never. More recently, we've got much more data that's really telling us about the importance of iron overload and that the trouble iron load causes our patients with MDS. And in fact, I'm not afraid to start iron chelation anytime I'm getting a patient that's upwards of 8 to 10 transfusions, provided I believe they're going to have an ongoing transfusion need. I don't think there's any benefit to letting someone reach some arbitrary goal of 20 packed red cell units or 30 packed red cell units. If the patient has an active disease, if the patient's requiring ongoing transfusions, I think chelation makes sense. There's some very fascinating data, and it's a challenge to interpret new data and small pieces of data, but there are certainly some suggestions that patients with better controlled iron levels tend to do better long term. We used to think that the only trouble you ran into with iron overload was 10 or 15 years down the line. Most of our MDS patients weren't alive at that point, so it wasn't pressing us. It now suggests if you have 100 patients that have well-controlled irons with MDS and you're treating them, and 100 patients with poorly controlled iron levels, you're treating them, the group with better controlled iron levels has better outcomes. And I think there's a lot of investigation as to why that's the case, but I certainly think it's worth considering early chelation in your patients.
You know, getting back to that earlier question about CHF, because I thought that's really interesting, and it's probably not rare. What about chelation in patients with MDS who have CHF?
Yeah, there's not a lot of data in our MDS patients that, if the implication is that iron overload caused the CHF or is making the CHF more challenging to take care of, then chelating them makes sense. I think it's hard to get iron out of organs like the heart, not as hard to get it out of the liver. So ultimately, if that's the case, I think that we don't have a lot of data to go on for there, but I certainly would encourage people to think about iron chelation because with the oral agents we have now, certainly much better tolerated.
So you might remember that during the CME symposium, Dr. Harwin from Naples, Florida, presented an interesting case of CMML, and we received this question from one of the audience members. What's the optimal therapy for a 50-year-old with CMML2 and 50% blast while awaiting a search for a transplant?
CMML is a very unique and interesting form of myelodysplasia. It's sort of the crossover between MDS and the proliferative disorders, or MPDs. It has features of both. And as such, it's never really had its own way to approach it and treat it. In fact, people will note that CMML was actually excluded from the IPSS, the original prognostic scoring system that we all use. So most IPSS scores don't really apply to patients with CMML. What I will tell you is there's a very interesting ASH abstract this year that is looking at specifically patients with CMML and trying to apply a prognostic scoring system to it. It had to do with being advanced RAB2. It was a poor prognostic feature. The number of cytopenias was poor prognosis. And of course, your white count was poor prognosis in the scoring system. So in fact, we are trying to make an effort to better understand CMML. Allogeneic transplant is potentially curative for patients with CMML, so I do believe that thinking about a transplant is the right thing to do at the time you first meet a patient. The question is, how do you optimize them and get them ready for a transplant? We know that traditional cytotoxic therapy has a lot of toxicity for patients, particularly older patients, and not so much benefit in the myelodysplastic world or the myelodysplastic syndromes. So what we have been focusing on is the use of DNA methyltransferase inhibitors as a frontline therapy. When you get patients that respond to DNA methyltransferase inhibitors, it appears that that is a good bridge to get them to a transplant. Obviously, patients that progress through these treatments need to go on to more intensive type therapy. So if you're looking at standard therapy, I would be thinking about DNA methyltransferase inhibitors.
Which one?
There are two that we use quite frequently, and there's actually quite interesting data with both drugs in CMML. 5-azacitidine is the DNA methyltransferase inhibitor of choice for a lot of MDS based on the survival data from the big multi-international study randomizing patients to 5-azacitidine versus a conventional care therapy of either supportive care, low-dose Ara-C, or Ara-C plus anthracycline as part of an AML induction. And it turned out the patients that were randomized to 5-azacitidine with high-grade MDS lived longer, and 5-azacitidine has become sort of the standard there. Of interest is that with D-cytidine, the other methyltransferase inhibitor, it turns out that there are data specifically with patients with CMML showing they have a very nice response rate to D-cytidine. So I actually believe you can use either of the two drugs for someone who has CMML that you're trying to stabilize their disease moving to an allogeneic bone marrow transplant.
So I have another question. If PDGFR is mutant in CMML, what's the dose of imatinib to use?
So imatinib, the very famous small molecule inhibitor that has been the focus of a real change in how we approach CML and how we approach Philadelphia chromosome positive ALL. Well, it turns out that this drug is not specific for BCR-ABL, which is the product for the Philadelphia chromosome. But in fact, it hits a class of tyrosine kinases, including mutated forms of KIT, for example. PDGFR is another one. Now, in the proliferative disorders, things like hypereosinophilic syndrome, and in disorders like CMML that might have a mutation of this receptor, there are reports of patients having very nice responses, mostly limited responses to the use of imatinib in that setting. Studies suggest that you don't need the full dose of 400 milligrams a day that you'd start someone with CML on, but in fact, even 50 and 100 milligrams a day show responses in many of the studies. So we have tended to start low, see how patients respond, slowly escalating the dose, and if you hit 400 milligrams a day and you're not getting any activity, chances are it's not going to be an effective drug for your patient.
What fraction of patients with CMML have mutant PDGFR?
It's actually a low number. It's probably in the range of maybe less than 10%. However, there has been an interest because of the tolerability, the good profile of imatinib, of people wanting to try it. So we often send this test out because it's not classically done in most laboratories. It's usually a send-out test.
That actually was another question. Which commercial lab in the United States performs PDGFR gene mutation tests?
Well, I believe our group actually uses the Mayo Clinic and their laboratory. They do a lot of molecular testing when other places don't. I don't believe that Quest Diagnostics does this, although they will do mutations of BCR-ABL, but I don't think they do PDGFR, but we send ours to the Mayo Clinic.
So we got other MDS questions, but let's do a little bit of AML. Here's one. An older patient, for example, 70 years with AML, not eligible for intensive therapy, on monthly azacitidine, has a change in blasts from 50 to 60% after two cycles of azacitidine. Should I continue azacitidine or change therapies? The patient is clinically mildly worse with slightly more requirements for platelets and red cell transfusions. How about if the patient was clinically stable?
Number one, I fear I'm awful late coming with this advice for your patient, but in general, when you have limited treatment options, I've tended to lean towards using them until there was a real objective failure. And so knowing that there aren't lots of treatment options available outside of clinical trials for patients that aren't candidates for intensive therapies, when we treat people with DNA methyltransferase inhibitors, we tend to continually keep them on it, and I would not be put off at all by a blast count from 50 to 60% after a couple of cycles. We know that these drugs take 2, 3, 4, 6 cycles till we can get objective chance of having a good response. So I might say that it's a bit early to abandon ship, and if the patient's tolerating it well, I would continue to use it. I'll say one other thing about patients with aggressive bone marrow diseases. When you're using these agents, one of the other things you're trying to do, yes, you want a response. That would be great. But the other thing you're trying to do is keep the disease stable and not let the disease get worse. And what I mean by that is transfusion needs might improve even if you don't get a bone marrow objective response. Quality of life might improve even without an objective bone marrow response. And so what I tell patients is I'm looking at the whole picture when I'm treating you with a DNA methyltransferase inhibitor because I'm substituting this for chemotherapy. And ultimately, I'm trying to keep you disease stable and your quality of life better. And that is possible.
So what would be your likely suggestion in addition to trying to get on a clinical trial if this patient definitely is getting worse?
Well, once the patients progress on a DNA methyltransferase inhibitors and they were deemed in the past not to be eligible for intensive chemotherapy, other agents that have been looked at more recently include drugs like clofarabine. Clofarabine is a drug that it's a nucleoside analog and it has lots of activity in AML. It's not to be considered totally easy therapy. It's intermediate intensity, and so you have to be willing to watch your patients very carefully. But there are responses in patients with intermediate doses of clofarabine in this setting. So that would be an agent that many of us might go to. If the patient was in Europe and the physician was in Europe, a lot of folks would use low-dose cytarabine. Again, the folks in the United States have not been as enthralled with that, and I think that's partly because we're continually trying to look for something a little bit more effective.
Here's another one. A younger patient, let's say 50 years old, with AML and deletion 5Qs in remission after standard induction. How would you approach post-remission therapy in terms of post-remission, high-dose IRC, autologous transplant, maintenance, lenalidomide, some sort of combination of these?
AML with a 5Q deletion cannot be confused with MDS with a 5Q deletion or MDS with a 5Q minus syndrome. In MDS, 5Qs have tended to be favorable prognostically. They are a very poor prognosis for patients with AML. So in fact, this patient falls into a paradigm in my mind where if you get a complete remission, we would be thinking about an allogeneic transplant for this patient. We would be searching for a donor. While we try to find a donor, we would typically move on to a consolidation course of therapy to keep the remission you've already gotten with your patient. We don't want to lose that remission. And so many folks would use a traditional ARA-C-based consolidation, and we would be in favor of that. If we had a donor right now in first remission, we would end up taking that patient to a transplant. knowing that the likelihood that chemotherapy will cure them, even with a full chemotherapy-based consolidation, is probably in the single digits. It's a low number that would be curative therapy for the patient.
What about FLT3? When's it get ordered? What about the other tests in AML?
FLT3 is probably becoming one of the most important and one of the most reliable prognostic markers for newly diagnosed AML. Of course, we're talking about the FLT3 ITD, which is the internal tandem duplication. That mutation universally carries a very poor prognosis. We have recommended strongly that a diagnosis, the first sample of bone marrow sent off for studies, include traditional cytogenetics, and of course, looking for molecular abnormalities like a FLT3 ITD. This is, I think, a really important test, and we recommend sending it off right away at the time of diagnosis. We also repeat the testing, regardless of the patient's status at their diagnosis, if they ever relapse. Because, in fact, a small number of patients who were FLT3 wild type may turn FLT3 positive at the time of their relapse, and vice versa. There are patients that are mutated at diagnosis upon relapse, actually are wild type. So I think that's a very important piece of information, so we really recommend testing. Now, just like we've talked about, when you have a poor risk patient, our focus tends to be allogeneic transplant as a way to potentially cure them because you don't have faith in the fact that chemo alone can do the job in these poor risk patients. There's been a couple of very interesting studies, again at this year's ASH, looking at moving patients very quickly to allogeneic transplant. And in fact, it appears that that's a favorable finding. If you have a patient with a FLT3 mutation and can get them into remission and move them to an allogeneic transplant pretty quickly, it appears that that offers them a more favorable outcome than delaying transplant.
What kind of numbers?
Well, the numbers of patients are small in these series because, again, some of these are retrospective looks at patients. Our group at Johns Hopkins in Baltimore has looked retrospectively and suggested that the time to transplant is probably very important. The German group does a lot of work in this area, and they've really built a system that says the quicker we can get you to transplant with a FLT3 mutation, the better. Those data appear to be holding up.
Before we go on to APL, just reflecting back on ASH in terms of AML and MDS for that matter, anything else happen that you think docs in practice should know about?
Yeah, I mean, it's a little bit disappointing. I think that this year's ASH was more building on what we've had before than it was brand new discovery. I found there are some very interesting new drugs, but very early in development in AML and certainly aren't ready for prime time, and we're just studying the biology. And then I found encouraging data of the use of existing drugs like the DNA methyltransferase inhibitors for AML, right? We've not really looked at studies specifically for AML with these drugs, and we're seeing success with them. And in some ways, we're seeing a little bit better success than anybody thought. That's both with azacitidine and decitabine. We're looking at novel combinations of drugs we already have. Example, the lenalidomide plus the azacitidine. Again, response is better than we thought. So I looked at this year's ASH as building on the foundation of the last few years, not necessarily going in a completely different direction with things.
This may be sort of a basic question I meant to ask. You mentioned lenalidomide, and when you were talking about it before, I was going to ask you, anything come out at ASH or anywhere recently that kind of struck your fancy about how that drug and the IMiDs in general work? I know it's kind of a basic question, but, you know, we had this lymphoma think tank and the responses there. You had response to myeloma, AML, MDS. You know, how do you think it works? And was anything new came out on it?
Well, a year ago at ASH, there was a plenary session talking about a model looking at the 5q minus deletion and why this deletion results in such a good response to drugs like lenalidomide. And they used microRNA techniques, and essentially what they did is they know that one chromosome's missing, and they began to knock out individual genes on the remaining chromosome. And what they really discovered is there's probably this ribosomal protein that tends to be very important in the development of 5q minus syndrome and 5q minus deletion, and is probably somehow playing a role in the unique response to the IMIDs and lenalidomide. Now, that's the very basic biology part of it. The translation of that is challenging because we don't yet know exactly how the lenalidomide is playing a role in there, but the fact that we could find a gene that helps recapitulate the disease and focus on the impact of the drug is a big step forward, and it was voted one of the best abstracts at ASH 2009. 2010, there was a lot of buildup towards this, again, continuing to focus on the basic biology and hoping we can get some better understanding of how best to use these drugs.
I mean, it's kind of interesting. And, you know, you hear people talking about anti-angiogenic effects or, you know, bone marrow microenvironment, which I don't really know exactly what that means. But any more in terms of those mechanisms, I mean, what you're talking about in terms of a specific protein, it kind of almost like it seems more intuitive.
Yeah, well, MDS is a very unique group of diseases. And we know that the stem cell, the hematopoietic stem cell, that damage plays a role here. We know the microenvironment of the bone marrow plays a role here. We know that the immune system and the immune system's response to the damage to the stem cells and the microenvironment play an important role in the disease that comes out the other end, i.e., someone with MDS with lots of cytopenias, someone with MDS with not so bad cytopenias, someone with systemic fevers and chills and feeling lousy, and someone who barely knows they have the disease if they wouldn't have had anemia on their annual visit. So we know that those three components really play a big role. And again, lots of people focusing on angiogenesis and microenvironment and the interactions of all the cytokines that go on in bone marrow are really doing their best to figure out how can we block the negative cytokines or the cytokines that probably result in cell death, poor differentiation, poor growth, and how can we maximize the cytokines and the microenvironment components that actually help the cells grow, if you will, or develop, if you will. So ultimately, there's lots of effort in that field, and I will not be surprised as we begin to knock out these different receptors and knock out these different cytokines that we'll be able to come up with a better cocktail to enhance the growth patterns in patients with MDS.
Do you see anything at ASH on pomalidomide, I guess the third generation IMID or something?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the data were more towards the myeloma end of things, but trust me, it's going to be looked at in MDS. It's going to be looked at in AML along the same lines, simply because the early work suggests that it is effective against these cell lines with myelodysplastic genetics or hits to them.
Interesting. Just taking a step back, thinking about these questions, from your perspective, what role does the immune system play in the action of some of these new biologic agents?
If you look at a drug like lenalidomide we just talked about, its impact on the immune system is certainly one way it's likely to work. And can you use a drug that would block the natural immune response to shut down the effects, right? So if you're stimulating the immune system to attack the leukemia or attack the MDS, your body's own natural response is to suppress that immune reactivity at some point.
Where does a drug like ipilimumab that we saw such exciting data in melanoma for fit in?
So when you look at a drug like ipilimumab that's trying to block the regulatory arm of the immune system and see if they can enhance the immune effects, you say to yourself, geez, wouldn't that be really neat to study in patients who are responding to a drug like lenalidomide marginally? Can we enhance that? Can we take someone that didn't respond to lenalidomide, again, enhance that until they turn into a responder? Those, to me, are sort of the low-lying pieces of fruit on the immunotherapy-type trials that we should be doing in our diseases, in our myeloid diseases. It's not easy because drugs like ipilimumab do have side effects and toxicity, so we've got to be careful in how we pick our patients and how we move forward. But certainly, there's interest and there's developmental programs looking at immunotherapy for myeloid diseases.
You know, that's kind of why I was asking before about the IMiDs, because, you know, there with the ipilimumab, you got the CT4, and you got the little algorithm there that almost makes sense to somebody like me. But then you start talking about, quote, the immune modulatory agents. And, I mean, do we know how it really affects immune function?
We don't. I mean, we know that lenalidomide or the IMiDs, we know that they can not only alter T-cell numbers, but they can enhance T-cell recognition of antigens. So we know that it's probably modulating the immune system in a couple different ways. So not only are your T-cells more plentiful, but they seem to be a little bit smarter early on. Again, the backdoor approach might be to cut off the suppressive arm of it and see if we can make that enhance those types of responses. And so I think that that's certainly something that we're moving towards. We need a little bit more data on the safety profile of some of these agents, but I think that they're quite fascinating, the results we've seen so far.
Well, now that I think about it, because, you know, ipilimumab has some, you know, sort of side effects that kind of make sense in terms of autoimmune function. Anything like that in the IMiDs? I was thinking about the rash. Is that immune?
Yes, I think it's felt to be. And, you know, biologic studies biopsying it will show T-cell infiltrates there in the rash,
really?
Just like you might say. It's not clear. And so, for example, we've done an interesting study in myelodysplasia with a whole cell vaccine that was developed, and it was built on the model of a CML cell line that was used to express myeloid antigens given to patients. And we did biopsies of their bone marrow, their skin, and their blood. And basically, we looked at T cells in each of those groups. And we said to ourselves, were there T cells tracking from the bone marrow to the site of the vaccine? And could we find them in the bloodstream? And in fact, we could find T cells that were very specific, that were generated as a response to this vaccine, that appeared to be trafficking around the body. So again, it's one of those things where, yes, some of these rashes, some of these local reactions to vaccines, some of these rashes related to drugs like lenalidomide and the IMiDs do appear to occur in the context of an immune response. Now, we don't know whether these cells are really effective at killing tumors or creating remissions, but that's certainly the implication.
Now, let's talk a little bit about APL. Here's one. What's the mechanism of action of ATO and APL?
If I said differentiation, would you believe me?
Sure.
We know that arsenic trioxide is a very important drug, and it's probably the first or second most important drug for this APL. And we know that patients who are treated with arsenic trioxide, either early in the course of their first diagnosis or at relapse, run the risk of what's called differentiation syndrome. So we're certain, as certain as we can be, that part of the mechanism of action of this drug is through a differentiation pathway. There's been lots of interest and lots of studies about how this drug can uncouple. There's been lots of interest how this drug can sort of uncouple the chaperone protein nature of the PMLRAR alpha, but we're just sort of learning of how to do this. We know that there are different proteins in the cell that are required to allow the impact of this fusion gene. And so one of the mechanisms of actions of this agent might be that it uncouples this chaperone protein idea and making the cells more vulnerable to die and making the cells sort of unleash the hold on the differentiation, if you will, from the gene. So there's a lot more to be done here, but it's certainly an interesting story that's unveiling, and we've long wanted to know why arsenic trioxide is so good, but we're starting to sort of scratch the surface of it now.
Interesting. Is Ara-C needed in induction therapy for low-risk APL?
It's not clear, and there are some now very neat data that say it's for sure probably needed in high-risk disease, and now there are studies actually trying to back off on the cytotoxics that are used in lower-risk disease. And it seems like in a couple of the larger studies from Europe that Ara-C is not the most important component for low-risk patients. The best stratification, I guess, we have for low-risk patients is really based on the cytopenias that you have. You want to have a low white count and a relatively preserved platelet count, and that tends to put you in a low-risk group. patients with a white count over 10,000 or platelet counts under 50,000 tend to be in a worse prognosis. So we use cytopenias to help us sort out the high and low risk patients. One caveat that the NCCN guideline group that I'm a member of for AML suggests is that if you're a team of physicians or a group practice that treats AML and treats APL, they recommend you really stick to one of the tried and true approaches, be it the Plethema group, Jemima group, whatever paradigm you folks choose to sort of follow in your practice, it's recommended you follow it straight through. And that's the best way to sort of guarantee or to give yourself the best chance of having good results.
You know, just kind of being an outsider in all this, I can't think of a disease more than APL that really needs to go to a tertiary center.
For sure. It's one of the ones we push for. This is one of the ones that I joke around with friends and I joke around with my fellows and say, this is the one I come in the middle of the night for. Most of my fellows can handle a lot of the routine new admissions of the general leukemia patient. But this is the one I come in, I look at the smear, I write the orders for ATRA that night, because to delay the use of all transretinoic acid in someone with APL or even someone with just suspected APL is really a shame. It is the most curable leukemia if you can get patients through the first month of therapy when they're at significant risk for either DIC at presentation or at risk for differentiation syndrome.
I'm not sure we know this exactly, but what do we know about, let's just say, the United States, fraction of people with APL who do die during that first month of complications, as you're just talking about?
There's been pretty big studies, again, retrospective in nature, where we have not cut into the 10%+ of patients that die at diagnosis or near diagnosis with APL. And that is even with efforts to get people to tertiary care centers, even with the introduction of all transretinoic acid, there's still going to be a population of patients that do not do well. But we really want to focus on getting more patients to a center, getting them started on all transretinoic acid, and being very aggressive in their management early on to try to see if we can cut into that 10 to 15% early mortality that sort of seems to hold true across the board.
How do you treat high-risk APL now that GO is not commercially available?
Our group never used gemtuzumab as frontline therapy. It was a great drug for APL patients, particularly those that could not receive anthracycline. So lots of groups wanted to take a high-risk patient maybe with a poor ejection fraction, saying, well, geez, we don't want to give you anthracycline. We built combinations of ATRA with gemtuzumab and found out that very, very effective. But that was not really part of our standard approach. So in fact, we have continually treated patients with anthracycline, Ara-C, and all transretinoic acid as sort of a standard induction regimen for our high-risk patients. I think where we really miss it is in that group that can't tolerate anthracyclines.
Here's the last one on APL. What's the harm of giving ATRA to a patient with AML, non-APL patient? Or what's the good, I guess, would be?
Well, I'll try to answer both of them. Number one, if you are suspicious that the patient might have APL, then we say start ATRA, and the risk of hurting the patient is minimal to none as far as we can tell. A few doses of ATRA while you get the cytogenetics confirmation back is unlikely to do anything to a patient that does not have APL. There have been studies to try to look at incorporating ATRA into induction-style regimens for not only poor-risk cytogenetic patients, but in patients over the age of 60, for example.
This is AML?
In AML, ATRA has been added to traditional regimens, and it does not appear that ATRA adds much to traditional Ara-C-based chemotherapy. So, again, trying to see whether or not the benefits of all transretinoic acid with APL can be extended to either older patients with AML or patients with high-risk disease does not appear to add much to it. I'm not sure that we really know how to use a drug like ATRA in that setting, so I'm not going to say it doesn't work. I'm simply going to say that the data so far don't suggest that it should be added to other regimens.
Anything interesting in terms of APL at ASH?
Again, APL is one of those diseases. We get interesting stuff every few years because a large study will come out and simply say, we've done 350 patients in Europe, and this is what we see now. Every group is trying to move towards a simpler regimen for APL and a more biologically based and less cytotoxic based. So we're trying to make the move and saying, can you get rid of ARA-C? Do you need maintenance strategies in people that really truly have low-risk disease? Those are the questions that are on the table right now. The biggest move a few years ago was really data that suggested that arsenic trioxide is not just for your relapse patients anymore. It should be a part of your primary therapy for patients with APL. There were some data that suggested those patients that got arsenic trioxide early in their course of therapy had better long-term outcomes. And so many groups, including our own, have really moved arsenic trioxide up into primary therapy for patients with APL. We just don't save it for relapses anymore.
What is the thinking, I guess, let's just say nationally or maybe internationally, in terms of non-protocol use right now of, you know, non-chemotherapy, all biologic treatment?
There's been an abstract or two and a paper or two looking at the combination of ATRA plus arsenic as induction, and it's very, very effective. What's missing? Long-term follow-up. We've got about a year to 2 years follow-up in these patients. These were groups of patients treated by the group at MD Anderson. And again, early on, the response rates seemed very good, very high, just like we would expect with a traditional induction regimen. But we just don't have enough long-term follow-up to say that these two biologic agents together are as good as or better than traditional approaches.
But am I correct in saying there are people, for example, some of the people at MD Anderson who are saying that time is now?
Absolutely. I think MD Anderson is a leader in this area. They've focused on trying to develop better therapies for even the good risk diseases like MDS. I think our group has agreed with them and we've partnered with them in looking at different trials. And what I would tell you is that what the U.S. needs to do is really develop the next cooperative effort to study APL, because I think there's a couple of neat questions that could be answered, and we need to do that within the confines of a cooperative group.